Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sadeh. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sadeh. On this episode, I'm joined by Michelle Lott. I say my two favorite kinds of episodes are either with fellow podcasters or with people I've interviewed before and have become friends with. In this case, it's both. Welcome, Michelle. Glad to have you on again.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
And Michelle is the head of Lead RAQA. Michelle, I wanted to bring you on to talk about FOIA. It was in a meeting a couple weeks ago, and the topic of FOIA came up, and I started doing some Googling in my free time and saw, you know, just how much is available with FOIA. And I was hoping to talk to you about what is FOIA, how can it be used in a medical device sense, and just maybe hear about how you've used it before. So what is FOIA?
Okay. So FOIA, it's the FDA's means to request freedom of information. And there is a special form and application you have to fill out about that particular information you want. Usually it's stuff that you know, most of the time might not be generally publicly available, but you still have the right to have access to it underneath freedom of information. Most commonly, with the CDRH and medical devices, we see that in copies, actual copies of people's 510K submissions. And it can happen two ways, because in the 510K, in one of the first sections, you have the option to turn in either what's called a 510K summary or a 510K statement. In the event you turn in a summary, it's more detailed. It gives like a high-level general description of the device. It gives the set of consensus standards and testing that it was tested to, an overview of its predicate comparison, and then a conclusion about substantial equivalence. And in the event that you do the summary, the way a competitor or the general public would get access to your 510K is to turn in one of these FOIA requests. And then the FDA gets the request. They send you a copy of your own 510K and ask you to redact it within a certain period of time and return it to them for provision to the requester. That's how the actual FOIA process works. But if you do a 510K statement, you basically turn in the statement with your 510K that says, in the event that somebody wants a copy under FOIA, you agree that you will redact it yourself and send it directly to that person that's requesting it from you. And you have to provide it within a small period of time.
So when you say send in on the 510K, that means when you submit. So you're saying that there are two 510, there you can submit 510Ks in two ways, either as a summary or a standard, or a statement. If you go the summary path, it's a detailed, it'll include things like standards, list of predicates, conditions and testing, and you have to make a conclusion as to the substantial equivalence. Those summaries are held by FDA. And in the event that, go on.
No, not quite. So that either a 510K summary or a 510K statement is just one small part of a larger 510K, larger submission. And you've got the choice of which one of those two you want to make. If you do the summary, it goes through the quote unquote normal FOIA process where the FDA kind of administrates that whole process of, like I said, getting you the copy, asking you to redact it, sending it back to the FDA. The FDA sends it to the requester. Whereas if you just make the statement, the requester comes directly to you and asks you to provide them a copy. And by, just by the nature of making a statement, you commit to that second process.
Understood. So what you're saying is that statement and summary are both elements of a 510K package. If you do, if you're requesting the summary, you have to go through FDA, and then FDA manages the redaction through the whoever the party is. They get it back to FDA, and then FDA gets it to you. If you want the statement, you request from FDA, tells the third party to send it straight to you, redacted.
Correct.
So that makes sense. Is 510K the only thing that you think is worthwhile from a compliance point of view, or have you used it on anything else?
For the CDRH, that is the bulk of the information that isn't readily housed in one of the databases. The FDA has got other information related to compliance, like warning letters, 483s, which 483 is the form that they write up their observations to a company on. They do a pretty good job of also posting summary data across all the companies they've inspected about the how the compliance issues break down by number and size.
So you can request 483s?
There's actually a database that you can just look them up. You don't have to request one.
From FDA. Is that right? That's regardless of center? Because I thought warning letters are published, but not 483s. Am I completely off base?
483s are published as well.
And are they, and they're both redacted, right?
Yep. Those are not, and those are not published redacted. They're published redacted when it's like literally referring to like maybe proprietary names or acceptance like criteria or something. But other than that, they're pretty detailed.
They're readable. Interesting. And you wouldn't request them redacted ever, or unredacted ever, right?
Correct. Because the type of information there that they redact out of them already is not anything that even if you requested it, that they would be allowed to give you.
So how have you used it?
I use it to the 43 in the warning letter database. I use it to kind of see current trends, see if there's any maybe changes in the numbers or types of the biggest observations. If there are anything that might suggest there is some sort of political focus or agenda afoot at the FDA. And then if there's any changes in expectations. So an example of where I used it to find out if the FDA had any kind of agenda about this particular type of product. I had a customer that was getting inspected by the FDA every year for what ended up being 5 years in a row. By the time
for
the
cause or just routine?
It was routine, but it was a risk-based assessment inspection, which means it doesn't necessarily mean it's based off the product. It means, or that company, it's risk based off of they had some particular reason or cause for concern about a product code as a whole. And then they start inspecting product, like all companies at random that make that same product. For this particular one, it was a product that technically you needed prescription to get, but it was industry standard that these companies had a standing order from the physician. So you could fill out this questionnaire, and the questionnaire was linked to an algorithm that said, if this person was here in my office, I would give them a prescription for this device. Now, prescription methodology is outside the jurisdiction for the FDA.
Is that right?
It is, because the practice of medicine is outside the scope of what they can legislate. But it irritated them because it was a workaround to where this was effectively an OTC product. Does that make sense? So they started inspecting a ton of companies that made this product. After a year or two or three years worth of inspections where they had zero 483s after every inspection, I was like, okay, what's going on here? And so then I looked up in these 483 warning letter databases that other companies who made similar products were getting inspected quite often for this particular product. And then B, that were having issues, that it resulted in warning letters. And then lo and behold, a few years after they got their last inspection, the FDA changed this product code to where it was eligible for OTC.
Wow. That's a good thing, right? They picked up on it. What else?
So something interesting that you can find related to FOIA. This is the 510K pre-market notification database. So for products in which somebody has already requested a freedom of information and the FDA has a redacted copy, you can put check redacted FOIA. You can put in your product code. Let's just look up a surgical mask. And by checking that box for redacted FOIA, you can find out if there's been any, you'll actually give you a copy of the redacted FOIA, and you don't have to go through the whole rigmarole of submitting the form and waiting, because FOIA can take several years.
Really? So that was my next question. So they call these redacted FOIA 510K? Why? Mm-hmm. Do you know?
Because as part of freedom of information, you do have the right to redact the 510K. So anytime somebody requests a freedom of information, that they're not going to get a full copy soup to nuts. You have the right to redact whole pages, sections at a time.
And they even have combination products, huh? As a check.
Yep.
Right there.
So yeah, you could put in any combination of these, but right now with just me going through some that I know off the top of my head, you could tell there's really not that many if once you get specific. But if I just wanted to know redacted FOIA, there's plenty, just not a ton. So let's look at this one, this AliveCorp. Come here and we've got a summary.
I've interviewed the founder of AliveCorp. So this is cool.
I think I've seen him speak several times.
Yeah.
Okay. This is very underwhelming. I don't see the button where. Oh, there we go. So see this third line item here? It says the FOIA releasable 510K. And you can click through. And it's going to give you a copy of what this person provided. And this will be a full copy of their 510K. Except for the sections that they marked as a confidential. Let's see if I can find an example of where they would have redacted it. Sorry if I'm making you dizzy here. So you can see this particular submission is almost 120 pages long without all the attachments that go with it. And so you're going to get most of, so see the, they redacted who, where their manufacturing facility was located with that big gray box. So anywhere you see the big gray box is the information that the company chose to remove. See, here's another one. And the detail, so this is a more detailed predicate comparison table than is typically available in the 510K summary that we talked about.
What does B4 mean?
It's the code. It's just the code that that says it's redacted, basically.
I see.
It might be the fourth location of information or something. I'm not entirely sure. So anyways, that's how you get to the FOIAs.
And it looks like it only goes back to 2017.
That likely means that there have been no FOIAs granted or processed since 2017.
Okay, so I think it just clicked for me. So it's not that all 510Ks are here. It's that all the ones that have been FOIA requested are here.
Correct.
Okay, so that makes a lot more sense, because I was like, what's the point of a FOIA request if they have it on a database? So that's clear. Now, in terms of timelines, you said sometimes it takes years. What does the timeline look like? So when you submit the form, you provide what information?
When you request one, you just fill out basically that you're asking for a life course 510K, and you pick the 510K number. Then the FDA sends that request to, say, a life core, and then a life core has whatever the number of days. I think it might be 30 days to respond to the FDA with all of those information blacked out that they should not have been publicly available. I have seen that process take over 2 years.
And so is it as simple as you would submit the FOIA request, they give it to them for 30 days or whatever, some day amount, right? It's not going to be a year. And then they send it back. And then where would it take 2 years?
It takes that long for them to just get the request and process it, because FOIA are free and they just have very limited resources compared to the numbers of requests that are coming in.
Oh, so there's a lot of requests.
Wow. There's both a lot of requests and a lot of, and you know, no real resources to process them.
So in terms of the timeline, it's as simple as submitting the request and waiting for it?
Yeah, if you're the requester.
Have you used it for anything else other than 510Ks and 483s?
I've only used it for 510K.
So the modernization of the FDA guidance list came out. There's the different tier of what we are to expect. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about it.
We've got two things that have happened almost back to back here. First, at the end of last fiscal year, which ended in September, we had the FDA issued this continued efforts at modernizing the 510K program with three new guidance documents. Let me jump down here to the bottom. This kind of gives you some context about those three guidance documents further up the page. And then here, it has the links to those guidance documents that include best practices for selecting a predicate for a 510K, recommendations for the use of clinical data in a 510K, and then evidentiary expectations for implantable devices that are eligible for a 510K.
So talk to me about that first one, because most of my experience has been on the NDA and BLA submission side for combination products. I don't really have any real experience with 510K. When they talk about guidance on selecting a predicate or whatever the name of their guidance was, I know 510K is obviously based on substantial equivalence to a predicate device, but if that's the, if end of the whole way that pre-market notification 510K process works, shouldn't it be clear how you set a predicate, since that's the basis for, do you get what I'm saying?
You would think it's even less clear now, in my opinion.
Really? So yeah. Tell me how it was before and then tell me what it is now.
So technically they're building upon the concepts of intended use and technological characteristics. And those have already always been the two main points that you had to prove that you were substantially equivalent to about your predicate. So what this guidance is attempting to do is add some detail around how you go about selecting those. And part of the reason why it's getting a little confusing, especially for a startup or a new user to these types of things that are trying to do their own research, is because the last time the FDA came out with some initiatives for the modernization of the 510K program, I believe it was like in 2018, but they flat out made a statement that we really don't think that you should use predicates more than 10 years old because they don't reflect current state of the art technology. So it's not the latest and greatest performance standard or safety criteria. Well, in this release, they flipped that and reversed it a bit. And then they tried to give you two equal and opposite examples of how, on this one hand, if these are the criteria, your 10-year-old or older predicate might be the one with the longest safety data. But in this one that's like software is a medical device at that, you're going to be best served by picking the new predicate. So now you've got like all these layers of things that you have to think about, which can get quite complex if you have like a combination of technological features and intended uses and knowing when you can do a 510K, or where do you have enough different stuff that you're de novo or of new, is also confusing underneath this paradigm.
De novo is under PMA, that's what it means?
A de novo is kind of in between the PMA. So it's things where you don't have an existing regulation or product code or an appropriate predicate to do a 510K. But it's not anticipated that it's high risk enough to be a pre-market approval for a high risk, life-sustaining, life-supporting type device.
What would be something like that?
Well, it's of new. So it's, say you have something that has a different intended use, but same technological characteristics, or different technological characteristics and same intended use, but in either situation, you just don't have a good predicate to say that you're substantially equivalent to because there are enough differences. And what happens, so you do a de novo, and if you're the first one, you have to do the de novo, but after that, the FDA, as a part of granting that de novo, issues a new regulation that usually becomes a class 2 product in which the next person can do a 510K instead of a de novo because now there's a predicate.
Got it. Okay. And so if I understood what you just said, once a de novo gets through, then it can be used as for other 510Ks as a predicate?
It's a predicate for the subsequent products as a...
And so how do you bridge the gap of either missing intended use where there's a gap there, or not having the same technological characteristics? In other words, sorry for asking the question twice, but the 510K process is, or it sounds like you're still trying to demonstrate substantial equivalence with de novo.
You still are. But now the, and that's where that the second guidance document on this list comes in, because it's about when to use clinical evidence to support your substantial equivalence argument, which 510Ks, it used to be like only 5 or 10% had clinical data in them. And a lot of time that was to validate like a marketing claim or something of that nature. Whereas now with this particular guidance document, and still trying to sort out, it's new, it gives you, again, more examples about conditions where you might have a different technological characteristic or different intended use, and the different scenarios where you might could use clinical data to stay in a 510K realm instead of a de novo.
Is there disadvantages to the de novo? Is it timeline or what is it?
It's timeline. So the average 510K review takes about 200 days and the average de novo takes about 400. So there's timeline, usually the size of the studies to demonstrate what you're trying to prove in terms of safety and efficacy are larger. And it's just more complicated for the FDA because as a part of that process, they have to actually issue a new regulation, write new laws around the product. So there's also a bit of a legislative process that goes with the de novo.
When you say write new laws, can you explain that a little more?
So in the 510K, you have to know what three-letter product code that you fit into.
Yeah.
That product code and all that's associated with it, like what type of submissions required or if it's exempt from a submission, GMP requirements, the definition of the intended use for that product, all of that is established through a legislative or rulemaking process. And so part of the de novo, they have to write that rule when they grant the de novo, not just grant the de novo.
Understood. Okay. So that makes more sense. That's what you were saying before, is that maybe I guess it didn't click for me the first time, but part of the difficulty with the de novo is that it could be the same device, but it's the same device in a new category, or it's the same category, but entirely different device, something like that.
There could be just enough differences in an intended use or a technological characteristics that you just can't say it's substantially equivalent to anything else that's already underneath existing class 2 regulation.
So FDA's Office of Combination Products has a request for designation. What's the word I'm looking for? They're responsible for doing RFDs, I'll say. And so is there any pre-submission meetings or something that you can do to understand if it's a 510K or de novo path?
There's a handful of different Q submissions, including the pre-submission and the 513G process. The pre-submission is a little, first off, there are no FDA fees associated with it. Its timeline is right around 75 days. It's a methodology you can't ask for clarification, but maybe validate your regulatory strategy or validate your test plan or different assumptions that you're making about maybe performance criteria. Whereas a 513G is a little bit more of a request for a firm classification from FDA, and they do their own research into existing regulations. They tell you if something exceeds exemption criteria, and it costs around $6,000 in FDA fees, and it takes supposedly about 75 days. But even though it has a fee and a timeline, for whatever reason, its days don't get tracked. They don't have the typical clock time for a 513G. So since COVID, I have had several colleagues that had friends that did 513Gs that took 10, 12 months. It was crazy.
Wow. So way beyond the 75 days. Interesting.
But I would definitely now, and now, because even though I hear a lot of people say that guidance documents and draft, but they're just that, they're draft, they're not binding, which is true technically, but they do reflect the FDA's current thinking on how they view things like the 510K process and biocompatibility and predicates and all these other things. And if you're not at least aware that they're out there, you're going to be missing a good bit in your regulatory strategy, and you might get surprised by FDA's response in your submission.
Have you ever seen it where that kind of thing has been successful? Where they didn't follow exactly what the guidance was and it was fine?
It took a lot of arguing and persuasion. Like, especially I did one where on an ultrasound device where an ultrasound final guidance document came out within 3 weeks of me putting the submission, right? 3 weeks before I put the submission in. And the FDA, almost all of their first round of questions came back about that guidance document. And I had already, I'd created a map of the new guidance document and the old guidance document and an explanation, which they conveniently did not see in their review. But so I had already had a plan and a strategy for it. And so there were some things that were like labeling oriented, where it was, okay, this isn't a huge, it's not a huge burden to comply, that we just did. But there were some things along the lines of testing that they wanted to see that we were more successful kind of pushing back on.
Well, very good. Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate you coming on once again. Always a breadth of knowledge. And I remember being in this meeting talking about FOIA and being like, I got to talk to Michelle as soon as possible. Any final thoughts?
No, I just hope that was helpful. And if I have any words of wisdom to share with your audience, they need to make sure they check out the CDRH proposed guidelines for fiscal year 2024 and see the about 50 or so more new guidance documents that they think that they're going to get to this year.
Where can people find you?
Find me? Mm-hmm. Oh, they can find me at www.leanraqa.com. And there's a link to where you guys can put some time on my team's calendar and we can see how we can be local.
Thank you, Michelle.